Okay, hi everybody. It's Monday, it's 1 o'clock, and it's time for Pirkei Avot, History and Hashkafa. Hope everybody's okay. We're all still continuing going out of Corona and trying to enjoy life. Although here in Israel we are concerned about the Indian variant, which may actually make us take a few steps backwards. I hope that doesn't happen, but we will see. We're on the third Mishnah in the second chapter of Pirkei Avot, of Masechet Avot. And the truth of the matter is that I had a full idea of what I wanted to talk about. And then I took a look at one edition of the of Pirkei Avot, the one, and it just jumped off the page at me. I'm referring to the edition of Pirkei Avot, which is contained in this collection. This is the a book by a collection of essays and commentaries by Rabbi Chaim Volozhiner, who was the premier, I won't say disciple, but certainly colleague disciple, Talmud Chaver of the Vilna Gaon, the founder of the Volozhin Yeshiva, which is really the first modern yeshiva in the, according to the model that we know. He developed the theory of what's called Torah Lishma, of studying for its own sake. There's Torah as the highest form of service of God. Now, he did not originate that idea. There were many people who came up with it, thought along those lines in earlier. However, crystallized it. And it is his work, Nefesh HaChayim, which is the first part of this little book, that presents the ideology of what are called the Lithuanian or the traditional yeshivot. He also wrote a commentary on Avot, and I've used it, referred to it a couple of times during these sessions. And we're coming up to a year. I mean, I'm wondering whether I'm going to turn this into a book. I don't know. Let me know if you think I should. Anyways, the... So I was looking at the just get the text of the Mishnah to read to you, and when I took a look at it, it reads in this version, which is simply a photo offset of an earlier printing. You find the following text: Hevu zehirim b'misha ein mekarvin lo la'adam ela letzarach atzman. Be careful of anyone who only brings you near or brings a person near for their own purposes or for their own needs. Nirin kahoavim, they appear to be lovers, loving, affectionate individuals. They appear that they really like you. Bishahanatam, when they need you, when your presence is to their benefit, then they will use you, then they will need you. But when it's inconvenient and when you need them, they're not going to be there for you. Okay, that seems to be a that would seem to be a pretty straightforward piece of advice. Be careful who choose your friends well. We've had this come up. We had a long discussion about almost a year ago about what the nation of friendship is. And we talked about Aristotle. And we talked about Cicero and all kinds of other things. And okay, fine. A real friend is a friend that is going to be with you through thick and thin. That's a nice piece. What else can you do with that? That's a perpetually relevant piece of advice. And a person is judged and also is influenced by his surroundings. All of these are wise sayings that you can always use. But I remembered when I looked at this, I said, no, that's not what the Mishnah says. The Mishnah says something a little bit, says very different. And here I'm quoting from the oldest a manuscript of the Mishnah, the Kaufman manuscript, which is conveniently provided in Zev Safrai's commentary on Avot. I think it's just him. Yeah. And the text is not be careful of those who will use you and then throw you away, but rather havuza hirim bereshut, be careful of what you do, of your relationships with the government, because they'll only use you for when they need you, and then when you need help, they'll turn on you on a dime. They're never there for you. That's a whole other ballgame. So the first question has to be, how come that mission, how come that word is missing here? So first of all, it's very clear that this is an example of internal Jewish censorship. Why would Jews censor their own books? Because from the 12th century, from the 12th century on, non-Jewish hostile individuals, first in the church and then in various governments, had people, whether they were former Jews who then decided they wanted to save their fellow Jews by undermining their Jewishness and bringing them in to be Christians, or whether to be, whatever the case might be, and who knew Hebrew, or they cultivated non-Jews who would know Hebrew, and then they would check the books to see that the Jews don't have subversive, insidious texts. So here. So less, so the word Breshut was taken out of it, certainly this edition, because there is a statement which is could be seen as seditious. So we take out the word government and put in the word a person, turning it into a universal piece of advice. With this in mind, I'll talk about this in a minute. I think I'll go more about this in a minute. I took a look at the commentaries on this Mishnah, and I was not surprised to find, but still, that my guess bears itself out. So, for example, let's run through. A few medieval commentaries. Okay? Maimonides, one line, says, we have already explained that reshut, which is the word, be aware of, be careful of the reshut, meaning the government, is reshut meaning the shilton, the governing authority. V'hu modia midotehem marchik mehem. All he's saying is, he doesn't say anything else. He says, he tells you how they act, what their midot, what their qualities are, how their modes of behavior are, and he says, keep away. That's all. Finished. Doesn't go further. Was Maimonides afraid of things he wrote for Jewish community? Absolutely. Oh, man, was he afraid. How do I know that? Because in at least one of his responses, I haven't done a full study of all the responses, but in one of his responsa, he writes a letter to a person whose name was Ovadia the convert. In the 12th century, there were actually two famous non-Jews who converted to Judaism, whose name was Ovadia. One was a Christian. Do I have the book here? Yes. One was a Christian. He was a former, actually, cleric. His name was Giovanni da Oppido. Giovanni of Oppido, which is a town in southern Italy. It's a wonderful book. It's unfortunately for you, it's in Italian, about him. And he, that's not the one we're talking about. He was a cleric and also a composer. And he composed Jewish Gregorian plain chant. It's amazing music. You can look up. There's a whole website dedicated to him and recordings of his music, which is really quite striking. You hear sort of like what you think is normally monastic music and with Hebrew words. Giovanni of Oppido, G-I-O-V-A-N-N-I of Oppido, or John of Oppido, or Johannes of Oppido, O-P-P-I-D-O, and you can see that. But that's not what we're talking about. There was another Ovadia, who was a Muslim who converted to Judaism. His original name was apparently Abdullah. Ovadia, Abdullah is the same name. Rav Ovadia, for example, Rav Ovadia Yosef Zatzal, his original name was Ovadia Ovadia Yosef Abdullah. His last name was Abdullah because he was named after Rav Abdullah Chacham Abdullah Somech, who was the chief rabbi of Baghdad and the chief rabbi of all Iraqi Jews in the early 20th century. So Abdallah Novaj is the same name, not a problem. Anyway, so he writes a letter to Rambam, and he explains to the Rambam that he had been studying in a Torah with a rabbi, and the rabbi had made fun of him and had told him all kinds of nasty things about Muslims, and therefore you're no good because you were once a Muslim. It was a terrible, terrible exchange that he had with his teacher. Maimonides happily ranks out the teacher and reassures reassures Ovadia that Islam is not a pagan religion, that he never worshipped the false gods, he never worshipped the Avodah Zarah, and then Maimonides says, even though Islam is a purely, pristinely monotheistic religion, nevertheless, there are other things that we disagree with them very, very, very emphatically, but I can't expatiate about them now. Why? Because of the evil ones or the low lives of Israel. What's he talking about? It's very simple. What happened was that Maimonides was writing to Ovadia in Arabic with Hebrew letters, or perhaps in this case he actually wrote them in Arabic letters, meaning that if the letter ever found, if he were to go on and write out a critique of Islam, then it might fall into the hands of the Muslim authorities, and Maimonides would have gotten in trouble because you're not allowed to criticize Islam according to Islam. And what was the fear? The fear was that some Jews would actually turn him in to the authorities, waving this letter. So he had to be careful. So Maimonides had to be careful of what he wrote. So he's very styptic here. That apparently, you have to be careful what you say. Okay, that's Maimonides. In the 13th century, in the 13th century in southern France and northern Spain, in Catalonia, Rabbi Yonah Gerondi, who was the cousin of Maimonides and the author, which Tom was with, another couple of months will be in Neville, and it'll be time to start thinking about doing, well, it's always a good time to do Tshuva, but we'll be involved in the run-up to Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. People will be learning Sharei Tshuva of Rabbi Yonah, one of the great ethical tracts that's still very much in use, very profound, very sensitive, if somewhat harsh sometimes, book about Tshuva. He wrote a comment. He was an ethicist, he was a moralist, and he also wrote a commentary on Havot, and see what he has to say. He says, "Havuza hirim birashut," and he says, "Be careful of the government, because you should stay away from the government, because." And then he adds, "Klomar litrachek me'ashel tonot," when bimekedem, in ancient times. Why in ancient times? In order so that this book ever, if it comments ever got into the hands or ever came to the attention of the government, they wouldn't say we're talking. You're preaching sedition. Why would that ever happen? Why would you ever think that? Very simple reason, because Rabbi Yonah, who lived in Provence, where there was a very active Catholic intellectual life, and also serious problems of heresy in the Catholic Church, was apparently very much aware of the fact that from the late 12th century on, the Catholic Church started to train clerics in Hebrew and Arabic, and the idea was that they would learn the sacred writings of the Muslims and the Jews and use them in order to undermine their religion and have them convert. Now, the number of Muslims that were involved or that were relevant to this undertaking was relatively small. Jews, however, another story. And in the 12th century, out of this school, it's what's called the Studia Orientalia of Murcia, came a large group of Jewish apostates. I have to be kind to them. Jewish apostates and non-Jews who learned Hebrew, and went and studied Jewish literature, especially the Talmud, in order to be able to somehow destroy the oral law, to destroy the Talmud. with the assumption that if the Jews don't have books to study anymore, or if they can, if somehow we they could not devalue, delegitimize the Talmud, that the Jews would have nowhere to go but to convert. The first tack, to which Rabbeinu Yonah was a witness, the first tack was one of aggression, meaning that the idea began to spread, or began to develop, that the Jewish books are actually, what's the word, are actually hostile to Christianity and to Christians. They preach sedition, they preach blasphemy against Jesus, they preach blasphemy against God, they preach hostility, never-ending, inveterate hostility to Christians, to the point of view that Jews will harm, physically harm Christians if they can. This is the same period in which the blood libels begin to really crystallize, although the first one was 1144 in England. And these apostates and born Christians would collect and take out of context all kinds of art, all kinds of statements in order to say, see, this is you. And therefore, since you are seditious, since you are dangerous, you have no right to live here. We question your loyalty. So when Rabbeinu Yonah therefore says, this is what it says, we're talking about the government's bimei kedem, meaning in ancient times, it's to say, no, this has nothing to do with us. Nothing to do with you. Chalila, God forbid. Now, is that true? No. Because the attitude of the feudal authorities, for example, in Christian Europe was exactly that. We'll use you and throw you away. You could never trust them. But you don't want to expose yourself to, you can't expose yourself to having the books burned. Well, really? What burned? Somebody mentioned book burning? The answer is yes. Now, I forgot to mention, to check how long, when Rabbeinu Yonah died. However, it's a fact that in the early 1240s, in the year 1240, actually in June of 1240, the Talmud was put on trial in Paris, in the palace of Louis the Ninth, who's known as Saint Louis, Louis the Ninth. Those of you who've been to Paris, if you've gone to the, I'm sure you've gone to the Ile de la Cité, the island of the city. At one end is Notre Dame. At the other end is the Palais de Justice, the Palace of Justice. That was the royal palace in which this trial took place. Big surprise, the Talmud was condemned, and after a lot of maneuverings to try to save it, 24 cartloads of precious, irreplaceable manuscripts were burned in Paris, which dealt a mortal blow to Torah study in France, the land of Rashi and the Tosafists. Where this happened is a matter of some dispute. There were those who claimed that it was in what was once called Place de Grève, which is on the north bank of the Seine, and others who say that no, it was in the Place de Vosges, which is closer to what used to be called the Pletzel, Place Saint-Marie. Doesn't matter. 24 cartloads of Gemaras of manuscripts were destroyed. To put this into some kind of context, and all of this could come out of finding a statement that was anti-Christian or anti-government. A friend of mine, a colleague of mine, Professor Simcha Emanuel, has a book which is called Shivrei Luchot, the sort of broken pieces of the tablets, and he estimates that if you towed up the number of books, titles, not copies, titles of books that we know existed in the Middle Ages, Hebrew books, Torah books in the broad sense of the term, there are approximately 35,000 that we know existed. De facto, in terms of what has reached us, in whole or in part, 7,000. So you're talking about when you're copying books, you have to be very careful for what you said. Anybody who read this would understand that we're not talking about bimei kedem, that you have to be careful of the government, but you also had to change the way that you're writing so that you don't expose yourself, you don't expose the books to confiscation, or the Jews themselves to persecution for having seditions, for seditious things. It's interesting. For example, he goes on, in the Rabbeinu Yonah goes on in this comment, he says as follows, Nirim ke'ho'avim b'shatan atam, when it suits them, when it's convenient for them, they look, they make themselves look like they love you. But when you need something, or you're in trouble, or you're no longer of any help to them, they don't want to know you. But look what he said. But this is how he says, and this really pushes proves the point I said. When there isn't enough money, he says, for Jews to give them or whatever, they won't do anything they don't want to know you if they can't get something out of you. And then he goes, v'kachu pshata mishnah. This is the straightforward reading of the mishnah, this mishnah rather. V'ima davar kein hu medaberet b'fgam ha'shulchan aruch. If so, then the parent meaning would be that it's actually talking about the seamy side of the government. And then he goes on, when it waves very uncharacteristic, if chalila, God forbid, lo yeha davar v'lo yakum. No, can't be. How can that possibly be? How could they say anything against the government? Val yadam mit kayem ha'olam kulo. The government keeps the entire world running. The hemosim dinu mishpat ba'aretz, and they are responsible for justice, and they do enforce justice. Vein ish yachol yuchal liot amiti kamotam. Nobody can be as real, as truthful as they are. Sheinan trichim lachnif ha'briot. They don't have to, because they can be straightforward, because they don't have to lie to anyone, because nobody's going to do anything to them anyways. Nobody can tell them what to do, so therefore they have no reason to be anything but totally honest and full of moral integrity and being upstanding. And then he goes on and on that line. Think of the kind of life. I mean, you're talking where he's living. You're talking about a period in which there was the beginnings of anti-Jewish agitation by the Dominicans in Spain. It was his first cousin Nachmanides who had a face down. 20 years later, had a face in the 1263 had a face down an apostate named Paul Christian, who, for the benefit of the Jews, he wanted the Jews to see the big world. He wanted them to become Christians, get with the program, get saved, and get good with Jesus. All right, but he did it by using the other tack, which was developed by the missionaries who taught Hebrew to Christians and were used former Jews to show that the Talmud is actually a Christian book. So once the Talmud is a Christian book, so then you might as well become Christian. You don't need to do all this other stuff. It sounds crazy. Yes, I know. But I give a whole course on this. It's a long discussion. In any event, the point is that all of this stuff, he was aware of this stuff. And as I said, any Jew who read this knew, stay away from the government. What is it in the Hitler on the roof? May God bless and keep the Tsar far away from us. That's exactly the case. Or as my accountant used to say, don't trouble trouble till trouble troubles you. Still, the intensity of the protest, the intensity of the remarks, no, Khalilah, God forbid. We wouldn't say anything about the government, because it'll come back to bite us. So that when you look at, so the reason I'm highlighting this is, first of all, because I was stunned by that first comment. But beyond that, it's a question of when you learn a Mishnah in Pirkei Avot. I've told you on many occasions that the comments reflect how they understand the words, and that can change from generation to generation. Sometimes it's what they don't say, which is important. when they tell you, oh no, don't say this, that usually means that that's exactly what it is. And you get a sense, you can re-experience the kind of political and legal and social circumstances which attended everyday Jewish life. The fact that even sitting in his study, Rabbeinu Yonah, when he writes this commentary, certainly when he gives, he gave sermons or classes upon which this, which ultimately was the basis for this commentary, that he had to count every single word, he had to measure every single syllable, because the implications, the long-term implications, were very, very serious if he slipped up. That should give us pause to appreciate, I think, the fact that today we can criticize the government. We can say as we wish in most places. And in fact, as the more modern commentaries come out, they start interpreting the Mishnah more closely to the obvious, straightforward meaning of the words. On the other hand, sometimes, you know, in totalitarian governmental and cultural contexts, it's still true. I have a friend, and you have to say something and then assume that your audience will understand it because you can't say what you really want to say. Example. A friend of mine, a colleague, Dr. Menachem Katz, who is here at the project, one of the world's greatest experts on the Talmud Yerushalmi. His father was the last chief rabbi of Pressburg. Now it's called Bratislava. It's a major Jewish community. It was the town of the Chassam Sofer and the famous Pressburg Yeshiva. Rabbi Yisrael Me'alau, in his autobiography, describes how he went with a delegation of rabbis to Pressburg in the 60s. Pressburg is in the suburbs at the time in Czechoslovakia. Now it's just the Slovakian Republic, Slovak Republic. And everybody talked about all kinds of stuff. And Rabbi Katz Sr. got up and said, "Vayidom Aharon." Aaron was silent and sat down. And that was a way of saying, I can't talk, because I'll be caught and my people and my community will suffer the things I say. So even something, in our case, even something so innocent as an ethical tract, seeking to give good advice, you either have to explain away the words which a hostile environment might attribute in terms of interpretation, to what the words mean. Or you have to censor out words which might be misunderstood or maybe properly understood. The way that the Jew is perceived by an outside world is often not easy. And as I said, what you say is often, and what you don't say, rather, is often as important as what you do say. But we do get a sense of what it was like to study Pirkei Avot in times so very different than our own. Okay, that's it for this week. We will see you next week, and take care of yourselves. Bye.